Hey everyone, ever feel like the finance world has its own secret handshake? Well, today we're diving into a phrase that's been popping up everywhere, secondary buyouts, or SBOs, if you want to sound like you're in the know.
And trust me, you want to know about this one.
We're not just talking about like companies changing hands.
Yeah.
This is one private equity firm.
You know, the big leagues of investors.
Right, exactly. Selling a company to another private equity firm.
And it's huge right now. We're talking 40% of private equity exits happening this way.
40%.
So yeah.
The million-dollar question is, are these deals really all they're cracked up to be? Or is it just fancy financial footwork?
That's what we're here to unpack. And you're right to be a little skeptical. See, private equity, it's all about the clock.
Tick-tock, tick-tock.
These firms, they raise tons of money from investors, right? And they promise big returns within, say, 10 years. That's usually the time frame they work with.
So they're under pressure.
Big time. They have to buy and sell companies constantly. And that can lead to some, shall we say, creative decisions.
Okay, I'm starting to see where this is going. That clock is ticking. The pressure's on. And suddenly, this whole SBO thing starts looking pretty good.
Bingo. Imagine you're a PE firm. You're nearing the end of your fund's lifespan. Got cash to burn. But finding the right company to buy, building it up, that takes time. Time they don't feel like they have.
So what's the faster, easier route?
Snagging a company that's already been PE owned, it's like the express checkout at the grocery store.
Less hassle, but maybe not the best selection.
Precisely. And here's the kicker. Research shows these rushed SBOs, particularly late in a fund's life, they often don't perform as well as other buyouts.
Hold on. Underperform? You mean they don't make as much money?
Sadly, that's often the case. There's a fascinating study out of Oxford that really dug into this. They looked at tons of buyouts and found that these late-stage SBOs often meant lower returns for investors.
Lower. How much lower are we talking?
We're talking situations where, on average, for every dollar invested, you might only see 88 cents back. Meanwhile, the stock market in that same period might have gotten you a dollar or more.
Wow, that's a big difference. Sounds like those deals that are too good to be true. But why is that happening? What's causing these poor returns?
Well, remember that clock we talked about? Picture yourself as that PE firm nearing the end of their fund's life. Investors are breathing down your neck for results.
And they've got to maintain that reputation, right?
Exactly. If you haven't deployed all your capital, it's like you don't know what you're doing. And that makes it hard to raise money for your next fund. No one wants to back a manager who sat on their hands while everyone else was profiting.
So they're stuck. They have to show they're making moves, even if it means potentially overpaying in a secondary buyout, just to tick that box.
Right on the money. It's short-term thinking, and it can lead to long-term pain. And here's the thing. The smart investors, they see through it. They know the game, and they penalize funds that rely too heavily on these late-stage SBOs.
Penalize them how?
That same Oxford study found that firms that made a habit of these quick flip SBOs often struggled to raise as much for their next fund. It's like a chef getting known for serving microwave dinners. Eventually, people stop coming back.
So it's a gamble for the PE firm and the investors who buy into those later funds.
You got it. But here's where things get even more interesting. While some SBOs reek of desperation, there are times when a second PE owner actually makes perfect sense, even adds value.
Really? So it's not all doom and gloom in the SBO world. There's a silver lining.
Oh, there's a silver lining. All right. But we got to ditch the image of just handing off the company and think more like a tag team wrestling match.
Okay. I'm intrigued.
Two heads are better than one, right? Mm. But only if they bring different strengths to the table.
So instead of just passing the baton, it's about finding the right partners, the right skills at the right moment.
Exactly. Let's say the first PE firm is incredible at streamlining things, cutting costs, boosting profits. They're the efficiency gurus. But maybe they don't have what it takes to go global or make a big acquisition.
That's where PE firm number two comes in, right? To pick up where the other one left off.
You got it. The Oxford study actually had a great example of this, a Swedish cable TV company called Comhem.
Comhem. This Swedish cable company, right. So they were doing fine, but then this second PE firm swoops in and takes them international. Is that what happened?
That's the gist of it. The first firm, EQT, they knew Sweden like the back of their hand. Made Comhem a local success story. But to really hit the big time, they needed something more. Enter Carlyle and Providence Equity Partners. Global reach, international experience, resources for days they could handle going global. They stepped in, took over from EQT, and boom, Comhem becomes something much bigger. And the numbers show it too. After that second buyout, their revenue practically tripled in just a few years. Textbook example of a well-timed SBO with the right players unlocking serious value. The key here is this idea of complementary skills.
Okay, so not just any second owner. It's got to be the right owner, the right skills at the right time. Like PE matchmaking. But how do you define complementary skills? What makes two PE firms click in the business world?
Great question. That Oxford study, they really dug into this. They found three main types of skill sets that make these XBO power couples. First up, you've got the clash of the titans, the margin expanders versus the sales growers.
Sounds intense.
Oh, it can be. Some PE firms, they're all about squeezing profits.
Yeah.
Cost cutting, lean operations, the works. Then you've got the others, the ones obsessed with growth, new markets, new products, always got to be expanding. And sometimes the magic happens when you combine those. One firm gets the financials in tip-top shape. The next firm takes that foundation and runs with it.
Optimizing what's there and aggressively growing it. One sets the stage, the other steals the show. I like it. What else makes for dynamic SBO duo?
Next, we've got the battle of backgrounds, the finance wizards versus the operations gurus. Think of it this way. Some PE firms, they're full of ex-consultants, industry vets. They know the business inside and out. Supply chains, production, you name it. Then you've got the firms run by like ex-bankers, financial engineers, masters of debt, deal structuring. They make the money work, even if they wouldn't know a factory floor from a hole in the ground.
So it's like a surgeon and a general practitioner.
Exactly. You need both for a good outcome.
I like that analogy.
And that brings us to the third type of complementary skill set, going global. It's the local heroes versus the global conquerors. Like our Conhem example, some PE firms, they're all about a specific region. They know the lay of the land. But to really break out internationally, a company might need a PE firm with, well, a global network. International experience, resources, taking a company global isn't as easy as just changing your shipping address.
Tell me about it. It's like the difference between knowing how to cook a great meal at home and running a restaurant empire. The skills are related, but it's a whole other ballgame.
You said it. That's where an SBO with that geographic expertise comes in. But that brings us to another interesting and sometimes controversial part of the SBO world, the investors themselves.
You mean the people actually putting up the money for these deals? What about them?
Well, sometimes those investors, they find themselves on both sides of an SBO. It all comes down to something called LP overlap.
LP overlap. Sounds kind of scary. Like a medical diagnosis.
Laughs. Don't worry, it's not contagious. LP just stands for a limited partner, which is basically a fancy way of saying investor in a private equity fund. Now, picture this. You're an investor. You've spread your money across different PE funds, right? Diversification, smart moves, all that. And then you realize you're invested in both the firm selling a company and the firm buying that same company in an SBO. Talk about awkward.
That's like showing up to a potluck and realizing you brought the chips and the dip.
Laughs. Exactly. And you can imagine this whole LP overlap thing has caused quite a stir. Some even call it a viral infection in the industry.
A viral infection. Okay, we definitely need to unpack this LP overlap thing. Why all the drama? What's the big deal?
It all boils down to fees. And the idea that someone might be double dipping. Remember how we talked about how PE firms get paid those management fees, the carried interest or the carry?
Their cut of the profits.
Yep. So with LP overlap, there's this concern that if you're invested on both sides, you're essentially paying those fees twice. Buying a firm takes their cut. Selling firm takes their cut. It's like going to a buffet and getting charged per plate, even though you're getting the same food.
Okay. Yeah, I get it. Paying double fees on basically the same investment. Not exactly a winning strategy. But if this LP overlap is so common, this viral infection, like you said, there's got to be more to it, right? Investors aren't dumb. They wouldn't just stand for that.
You're catching on. It's not as simple as it looks. To really understand, we got to go back to one of those private equity quirks, the whole lifespan thing. Mm-hmm. Remember how those funds usually run on a 10-year cycle, big pile of cash up front, and investors are along for the ride, for better or worse.
So even if an investor knew about this double fee situation, they couldn't just pull their money out early.
Nope. Which means, financially speaking, LP overlap in an SBO might not be as bad as it seems. Think about it. Even if that SBO hadn't happened, even if the first firm held on, the investor wouldn't have seen their money back any sooner. It all comes back at the end of the fund's life anyway.
So it's like paying for your meal in one go versus paying it off over time.
Mm.
Still the same total amount. Just spread out. And with private equity, that spreading is pretty much set in stone.
Nailed it. Now, I'm not saying those double fees are good, but when you look at the big picture, that whole lifespan of the fund, which is how most PE investors operate, those SBOs with LP overlap, they might not be eating into returns as much as people think.
Okay, you're making my head spin a little. So less about investors getting totally ripped off, more about the optics.
There it is. The optics ain't pretty, and it definitely raises questions. But here's the catch, and this is where it gets interesting. This whole LP overlap debate, it points to a bigger issue with private equity. That pressure to spend money, even if it's not the smartest move, those incentives we talked about, that ticking clock, it can make fund managers jump at any deal, even selling to another PE firm they're invested in, just to look busy.
It's like when you've overbooked yourself and you're just trying to make everything fit, even if it means saying yes to things you'd rather skip.
Lasses. Except instead of a busy weekend, it's billions of dollars, high-stakes musical chairs. Which brings us to a big question for anyone looking at private equity, newbie, or expert. How do you navigate this and make good SBO decisions? Because it's not always clear-cut.
Right. We've opened up this whole SBO can of worms, and there's so much to consider. Is it actually adding value? What are the PE firm strategies, this whole LP overlap thing? It's a lot, even for someone like me who geeks out on this stuff all the time.
Yeah.
So for our listener who's been following along, what are the big takeaways about secondary buyouts?
I think the most important thing is SBOs are complex. They're not inherently good or bad. Could be a PE firm trying to make a quick buck, or it could be a smart move to unlock some serious value. You got to look deeper than just the surface.
So don't write off SBOs completely, but figure out the why, their motivation.
Exactly. Due diligence is key. Just like with any investment, you got to know the PE firm's history, their strategy, what makes them tick, and why they're doing this specific SBO. Don't assume it's bad. Pop the hood and see if it makes sense.
How would you recommend doing that? What should investors watch out for?
One thing is a pattern of these late-stage SBOs. If a firm's doing this a lot as their fund nears its end, that's a yellow flag. Could mean they care more about appearances than getting those returns for investors. Another thing is the fees, especially with that LP overlap. Is it transparent? Does it seem excessive? And maybe most importantly, do you understand why the fund manager is doing the SBO? Does it fit their plan? Do they have a vision for making it work? Or does it feel like they're just shuffling papers around? Those are all things to ask.
This has been an awesome deep dive. Thanks to that Oxford study, we really got into the nitty-gritty of secondary buyouts. We saw the good, the bad, and the potentially messy. But as we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with something to think about. If you were in those investors' shoes, sitting at the private equity table, how would you approach this now, knowing what you know about SBOs? More cautious, more picky, or would you see them as hidden opportunities? Food for thought as you navigate the ever-evolving world of finance. That's all for this deep dive. See you next time.